we're continuing the interview with Harry Conger on January 17th, 2000. You were just saying that a trophy about 3 feet high?
About 3 feet high. Gary Prazin.
One of Gary Prazin's miner statues.
Miner's trophy with a guy single jacking on a face.
These are bronze.
These are bronze figures, yeah. And this Distinguished Member Award and trophy, or sculpture, were started by Ralph Bailey. Ralph had been active in the American Petroleum Institute, which was the equivalent of our mining congress in the petroleum industry. And they awarded one of their people this award whenever they felt it was deserved. And so his last year in the Congress, he had the board, you know, propose this, and the board voted to start making this award the next year. Well, I was chairman the next year, and I got to present the first award to Ian McGregor, who was Hamax Climax guy, deservedly well-known person in the business. And then the next year, I got to present one to Plato Malazimov, who was another giant in the industry. And the third year, my last year, I got to present one to Chuck Barber, who was the former chairman of ASARCO, the company with whom I started work when I got out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always sort of kept tabs and contact with those people just because I liked them. And so it was great fun to be able to present Chuck with his. So anyhow, I got to present the first three at three people that, you know, I had known since I was a young guy, known of, and got to present them with their awards. But in any case, I was lucky enough to receive one, I think, in 92 or something like that. So that was
Where is
very
it?
Nice. It's in my den.
I don't see it here, so it's at
home. No, I don't keep that kind of stuff
around
here.
Pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Hard to move around.
Oh yeah, it's hard to move around. That's for sure.
They're beautiful sculptures.
Yeah. Next time at the house, I'll show it to you. So that was an activity outside of.
Well, that's really the pinnacle of mining achievement, isn't it?
Well, it certainly was a great honor, mm-hmm. and I was just really privileged to serve the industry in that.
That's the top.
Now, another thing that I became involved in was the World Gold Council. And we've talked about that earlier. And just to recap that quickly, it was an activity that was designed to market gold. And the South Africans had pioneered this, had done very good things with it in the late 70s, early 80s. And because of apartheid, were starting to be denied access to media outlets in North America. And so they were looking to create another organization that they could participate in and help fund, but yet wouldn't be seen as a South African activity, and therefore deny the gold industry the opportunity to promote itself. And so because of Homestake's longstanding position in the gold mining business, it predated the South African mines by 20 years or so. The South Africans and the Homestake mine have been associated with one another for years on technical matters. And so that plus the fact that I was associated with South African mining companies through a directorship that I had, ASA Limited, they came to me and suggested that we think about forming a world organization of gold miners to promote gold generically. And so since Paul Henshaw and I had sort of been following the South African activity of marketing their gold through an organization that they named Intergold, we were impressed with what they were doing. So by this time, Paul was no longer active, but that earlier time that he and I watched this made me think that, there probably was time to form an organization like that. So I agreed with the South Africans that we ought to do that. We convened a meeting in the Homestake boardroom in the summer of 86 to do that and pick up from the South Africans the structure that they had already put in place, move it to Geneva from Johannesburg so that it had an international base, and start out new members. I think we started out at $2 an ounce assessment, each of we new members, while the South Africans continued to pay, I think it was $3 an ounce or something more than
this
we were paying.
This means an ounce of your production.
Ounce of production,
annual,
yes, annually.
Production.
Paid that annually, right. Ounce of production annually. And
$3
so,
seems like kind of a steep assessment, isn't it?
Oh, that's what everybody thought. But the South Africans were paying more than we were. That is steep. That turns out to be, the $300 gold, that's 1.5%, something like that. So it is a lot.
You must have thought it was pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of
our Homestakes, by this time, Homestake was producing over 1 million ounces. So we were spending, our tab was, I think we were at $5 an ounce. I'm sure I forgot.
Wow.
But we were paying $4 or $5 million a year for this. And other companies were paying the same thing. Mm. So we agreed to do that. And we got good support from Newmont, who was one of the big producers then. Barrick was just coming on, and they became active in it. Placer Dome. At that time, early on, it was Dome, and then it became Placer Dome, were members. And then Western Mining in Australia was at our first board meeting in our boardroom, and they came on board. So we were really quite successful in expanding from just a South African group to an international group. Right out of the box, and we had the whole thing set up by 87, and we're out promoting the World Gold Council under that name in 87 and onward. Now, some will say coincidentally, and others will say because of what we were doing, all of a sudden, the use of gold and jewelry went up dramatically. In 87, 88, 89, we saw a tremendous increase in gold jewelry sales. Ounces of gold going into the jewelry trade. And by 1990, the jewelry trade was actually using more gold than we miners, not just the Gold Council miners, all gold miners were producing. The jewelry industry was using over 100% of the newly mined gold each year. Hmm. So, as I say, some will say, well, that was coincidental, and others will say, well, we were promoting gold. What did you expect? Certainly, our World Gold Council staff told us that. So, at any rate, part of the incentive to start the Gold Council was we could see, we gold producers could see with the Barricks of the world and the other companies coming on with these new projects, large producers, that there's going to be a lot more gold coming on the market than we had seen before. And one characteristic of the gold market had always been that we could always sell our gold every day. We cleared the market every day. It didn't sit in inventory. It was only a question of what price we sold it. And we, most of us fixed it on the London AM or PM fix. And that was the only question to ask was, okay, what's the gold price today? But there never was any question, can we sell our gold today? Gold cleared the market every day. Now, with gold production forecast to double in the next 10 years, would that still be the case? And so that was one of the things that caused us to invest this $5 million a year in promotion to make sure that didn't happen, that we didn't start to see inventories of gold like we do copper and other metals. And so, as it turns out, whatever the reason is, gold and jewelry just took off. And so it did not become a problem of being able to market our gold every day as we brought it to market. So we achieved that. Now, we had hoped that in all of this, there would have been an appreciation of price that would be seen as worthwhile by the buyer of gold, either in ingot or jewelry form. We did not see that. And all during this period of time, we saw the gold price slowly erode from the high 300s down to the 200s, the high 200s, which is where it's been for 10 years now or so. So we achieved one part of the goal, which was to see the gold clear the market every day and not be inventoried by we miners or some middle people with an overhang to then match the overhang of central banks and governments that hold gold. And that part worked. Well, what didn't follow what we had hoped would happen was that the price of gold would continue to move with at least the inflation increases, so that we didn't lose any ground. But we didn't see that happen either. The council has gone through a tough period of time, as organizations do when markets are not kind, and membership was becoming more of a problem as we went into the 90s, and so the council had to make some tough choices and changes. One of the things that I didn't mention was how the council was structured. We had a board of directors, and any member company, whether they had a member on the board or not, and the directors were picked by country and company, and each country was allowed two directors on the board. And so then it was up to the country to decide amongst its gold producers who was going to be on the board. And so usually it was the larger producers that were on the board. And in the case of the United States, Homestake and Newmont were the two largest producers. So we were organizers of the organization back in that meeting in 86. And subsequently, we stayed on as board members because we were the two largest companies.
Who was your counterpart in Newmont at that time?
Gordon Parker. And he was at the original meeting, very active, and that's a great lead-in question because we had to pick our first chairman at the organizational meeting. And somebody suggested that I be chairman of it. And I said, well, I know we're meeting in my room, but I said, I'm still chairman of the Mining Congress, and I won't have time to do that. I can't do that. I appreciate your suggestion. I forget who it was suggested. But I said, I think a good person to do that would be Gordon Parker. And so we started out, Gordon was our first chairman, and we set it up that we'd rotate the chairmanship 2 years, sorry, 3 years at a time. Yeah, there were 3 year terms, but a year on year, but as many as 3 years. And we'd rotate by country. And so the US would be first, Canada next, Australia next, and then we figured that'd be far enough down the line that we could have a South African be a chairman. By that time, it would not be seen as a South African organization. And so that's the way we set it up. So Gordon was the first chairman from the US. Then we went to Canada, and Fraser Fell of Placer Dome was chairman. Then we went to Australia, and Hugh Morgan, Western Mining Managing Director, was chairman. And then we went to South Africa, and Goldfields, Robin Plumbridge was chairman.
Robin?
Yeah, Robin Plumbridge. He was managing director of Goldfields. He was chairman. And so that takes us up to about 92, I guess. Three, six, nine, 12. Must have been 2 year terms. Two, four, six, eight. Yeah, 2 year terms, not 3 year terms. So then that takes us up to 92, I guess it was, or 93, and we're back to the United States again for chairman. So I was chairman then for 2 years. It must be 93 to 95, or 90, let's see, no, it was 95 and 96, I guess I was chairman. But in any case, when it got back to the United States again, whether it's 2 years or 3 year terms, I'm pretty sure it was 2 year terms. But by the time I became chairman again, we were seeing the gold price continue to drop. Membership became more and more of a problem. And emphasis on the marketing of gold. Some of us felt the emphasis needed to change because gold jewelry was great offtake for our gold production, took it off the market, and it was what we call sticky gold. It doesn't come back on the market very easily because people don't normally sell their jewelry. That was all good, but it made gold more like a commodity, and so it didn't express gold's other value, which is a store of wealth. And we needed to do more to promote gold as an investment medium, as well as an adornment, which we hoped and felt might call for a higher price than just selling gold as a commodity. So it was during that period of time that I was chairman that we really started to address that issue. And all the while we had to keep downsizing because the revenue was less. We were losing members because of the high assessment that we were charging ourselves, and companies just didn't feel they could afford to pay it. And so we had to go through that again for that with that organization, downsizing, trying to be more efficient with what we have, and also change the direction of our promotion. Not so much in jewelry, but more in store of wealth attributes of gold. And that, of course, gets to be a philosophical kind of discussion, and it's a lot harder to demonstrate what kind of impact you're having on that versus jewelry, where you can count up how much jewelry is being manufactured every year and sold. So we went through that period of time.
Of course, in Asia, it's both.
Exactly, it's both. And we tried to point that out to a lot of people in the Western world that look at our friends in the Eastern part of the world that use high heritage gold as an adornment, but it's really money. Mm-hmm. And they can exchange it for money anytime that they want to. So that was a key part of the argument of East versus West, and why aren't we smarter in the West? But one of the things that has happened recently that really has made the Gold Council what we had hoped it always would be, a spokesman for the gold industry, but a force in the industry. And that event happened just last year with central banks starting to sell gold in the mid-90s. The Dutch started the first, the Canadians have sold virtually all of their gold to government. That became a real burden for the industry to bear, because if the central banks that had held gold as an asset were selling it, wasn't that really saying that gold has no other value other than jewelry? That's really the only value there is. So the World Gold Council and the Gold Institute here in the United States, both organizations, and both were equally effective, petitioned Congress early last year successfully to not grant further IMF loans if the IMF was going to sell its gold. See, the IMF was set up years ago with each of the participating countries putting gold into the hands of the IMF, with which then they could collateralize that and loan money to third world countries to help them develop. The IMF back in the late 70s had a series of six gold auctions to raise money to help third world countries, because the gold price had started to run up back then. And so the IMF had a series of six auctions, and interestingly enough, in each auction, the gold price was higher than the preceding one. Mm-hmm. And by the sixth auction, the third world countries that were going to be the beneficiaries of that sale said, hold it, just give us the gold, don't sell it. They wanted to take the gold and let it appreciate. And that was the last auction that the government held, mm-hmm. until last year, and a lot of pressure for the Treasury or for the IMF to start selling gold again. And the Gold Council and the Gold Institute successfully petitioned Congress to not fund any further IMF loans if they're going to sell any gold. And the IMF agreed to that. And then within months, several months, a consortium of 15 of the central banks in Europe agreed on a five-year moratorium not to sell gold. And so those two things really showed the strength and the value of the World Gold Council and the Gold Institute. So those, in my mind, justified all of the effort and work we put into it, and money we put into this organization to do just that, to have just that kind of influence. Mm-hmm. So
now you mentioned the Gold Institute, and the difference between that and the...
Gold Institute is a group that goes back, oh gosh, I can't remember how many years it goes back, but well into the 60s and maybe even the 50s. Strictly U.S., non-political, and so it didn't lobby. But what it did do was track and monitor gold sales in the U.S., actually worldwide, but primarily in the U.S. And was a source of information and knowledge for Congress on gold. And they didn't lobby, they weren't registered as lobbyists. They didn't lobby, which really made them more effective because it wasn't a political thing. They were a source of information and data for the government that was unbiased. So it existed in that form for years and years until about 92 or something like that, 91, 92, 93, somewhere along in there. There was so much adverse activity against mining and gold in particular that the Gold Institute reorganized itself as a lobby group so that it could petition Congress on issues like the mining law and other matters that like the IMF sales and so forth. So it did become a lobby group in more recent times. But it's been very effectively run by a fellow named John Lutley, who has tremendous respect in Congress and the various agencies of the government, Treasury and the other agencies, because he's just such a forthright, honest guy. And they still use him as a source of information and understanding of gold and its role as asset as well as jewelry.
What has been your relationship with the Gold Institute?
Well, Homestake was one of the early members of the Institute. I, because of these other things I was doing, I never did go through the chairs at the Gold Institute. Jack has. And I'm sure Paul did before I showed up, but I didn't take any leadership role there.
I think Jack has recently been president of it, hasn't he?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you were not
no.
closely involved.
No, no, but excellent organization, and John Lutley is just one of the best people in our industry on that side of the house, very capable. So that was the mining card. I think I mentioned earlier about the Western Regional Council. We've already talked about that, which is a Rocky Mountain organization that we belong to, and still belong to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another lobby group that was effective more so in the earlier days and now because it's expanded to include states like Hawaii and Nebraska. But originally it was just the Rocky Mountain states. Mm-hmm. But that organization continues. Then I've enjoyed directorships on some other boards. And I think in order of election to these boards, in 1982 I became a director of Pacific Gas and Electric Company, which is the Northern California Gas and Electric Utility, and still by most standards is the largest investor-owned utility in the country. And then in 84, I was elected to the board of the California Portland Cement Company, who make cement in Southern California. And later, that company merged with Consolidated Rock to form a new company called CalMat. And they were in the cement and aggregate business from that point on. And then in 86, I was elected to the ASA board. That stands for American South African Limited, which is a mutual fund, closed-end mutual fund of South African gold stocks. It's a South African corporation, but it's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and therefore U.S. citizens can own shares in a company that owns shares in South African gold stocks. So again, those investors don't have to go through ADRs to invest in South Africa. So as I say, I went on that board in 86. And then in 87, I was elected to the Baker Hughes board. Baker Hughes is an oil service company. The year I was elected, in fact, my first board meeting, the Baker merged with Hughes. Actually, they acquired Hughes Tool, forming what then became Baker Hughes. And so I joined the company just at that meeting where those two companies were joined. And I served on that board. Now the status of those boards are PG&E, I am still a director.
Yeah, just a second.
Well, I was just going to say what the status of those boards are now. PG&E, I am still a director and will be until a year from this April when I reach the age of 70, and that's mandatory retirement. CalMat was acquired last year by Vulcan Materials, an East Coast aggregates company that acquired CalMat, and so CalMat went away, and so I retired from that board. None of we CalMat directors went on the acquiring company's board. The ASA board, I am still a member of that, and likely will be for some time. Our most recent chairman retired as chairman when he was 89. So I will continue to do that for some time. The Baker Hughes board has a mandatory 10-year service period, at which time you step down, or age 70, whichever comes first. So I, in 97, I had served my 10 years with Baker Hughes, and so I have stepped off that board now. But then the following year, in 1998, a small startup silver company had approached me while it was still a private company, to start working with them. And I saw some interesting things that they were doing, and I'm a great believer in silver, and not believing that it's going to see its demise because of digital cameras. I think it's going to continue as a valuable metal. So I had been working with them, and then they went public last year, and actually went public in the fall of 98, and I went on that board, so.
What is the name of that company?
That's Apex Silver Mines. And it's listed on the American Stock Exchange. All of the other companies are listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Apex Silver is on the American. So those are the public companies that I've served on. And then the other board that I'm on is on the Board of Trustees of California Institute of Technology. And I joined that board in 1984 and have greatly enjoyed that association with some very remarkable people, both in the faculty and on the board. It's been a very rewarding experience for me. In 1990, I was elected to the National Academy of Engineering, which I was honored to be so recognized. The Academy is a sister academy to the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine. And those three academies jointly sponsor the National Research Council and the projects that they undertake. The Academy of Engineering has about 2,200 members now, I guess, representing all of the different engineering disciplines in the United States and foreign. There are foreign members in it as well. So it's a small group, and I certainly was lucky to be selected as one of the people to be in that small group. So that, that's about my list.
Okay, well, I think that probably time to stop
now. I think
now,
it's time
but,
to go grab my lunch, yeah.
But I'd like to, I'd like to go back and delve into each one of those things more.
Okay.
I think that
okay.
It's not fair to just give a list of those important things.
Okay. Okay, that's some interesting thing, especially PG&E.
Right,
with
right.
Diablo Canyon
really
and all that stuff.
We want to get into some of those things. And also, I, I guess I'll just turn this off. I selected the 1991 annual report as one that I thought you might want to
okay.
I don't know, do you remember that one in
no.
particular?
No, 91, no.
It's not very long ago.
No, I know.
But what you said here was that this was the year of the dog. No, I've forgotten.
Well,
exactly
leave that with me.
You
let
said
me,
this
let
is
me
one
peruse
of the worst
that.
Years ever. Thought
well,
you
it was,
might want
it
to.
It was a grim year, I remember that.
Yeah, it was. By several measures, 1991 was the most difficult year in Homestake's 115-year history. And this is the letter over your signature.
Let me
and
let
I
me
just
review
thought,
that before next time.
That must have been a very difficult letter to compose.
Yeah. That's,
anyway, I thought we might
let's,
give you a chance to look back at that and see if you were right.
Yeah, we'll see if it was the worst.
Did things get better after that or even worse? Okay.
Yeah.
Well.